My name's Deborah Askenes. I have a company, Community Organizer 2.0. I actually come at this from a history of community organizing where, there were so many crazy people who disrupted our organizing efforts in our communities.
Passionate
people, right, who love to take conversations outside of where they should be going. But in my role as a consultant around social media to nonprofit organizations, I primarily talk about building community, and I think of myself as an engagement strategist, and I have not only worked with organizations that struggle with personnel issues, but at one point I was the community manager for all of the firstgiving.com online communities, and I'm going to talk about that later today, and that struggle between what I found about how you do or do not insert yourself personally into that community.
It's Jess.
My picture's up.
It's
so, you know.
Alphabetical. You guys are organically ordered.
Okay. My name is Jess Main. I work with the National Center for Media Engagement, which is an organization that's part of public media. And our mission is to support all public broadcasting stations around the country, specifically with their community engagement efforts. And we provide tools and resources, professional development. And one of the things that we definitely work on is social media presence, online, multimedia stuff for stations and helping stations figure out issues like this one. And I think one of our tools and resources is here today as well. And then outside of NCME, I have also worked with a number of different arts organizations establishing social media presence, so I have some perspective outside of that as well.
Thank you. So my name is Vanessa Rinesmith. I'd like to say I had a lot of fun last night, but no, I just from lots of conversations with folks. So I am the director of outreach for Start Some Good, a newer-ish crowdfunding platform for social entrepreneurs. In addition, I also work with TechSoup Global in a community and communication strategy capacity. So my background is actually an interesting mix of both the for and the nonprofit space, having worked originally within internal communications with a larger insurance company. For me, what I'm seeing both from the experience with larger organizations and more specifically with smaller ventures, whether it's a for-profit or a non, is really sort of this challenge in terms of social media and managing and a limitation of resources and how that also impacts a lot of this as well. So we bring sort of a lot of that lens from both a small and a large scale experience.
So I'm not going to really stand here because this intimate group that we can create. Yes, okay. And as Jess mentioned, we actually have some social media handbook policy resources that you can get if you ask a question or share an example every time. It's like, bam, every time. It's like, it'll be the same letter every time. But it'll be for you.
And can I just add one thing to that, Amy? That toolbook or handbook was created specifically for public media stations, but I think there are a lot of resources in there that are applicable across the board. So don't feel like it might not be of use to you if that's not where you're from.
Exactly.
In other words, you can't decline the gift.
You can't. It's in front of everyone. I will, like, do that you touched it last second. So so, this is not going to change now. But that bit links to a public Google Doc, so if you have a great example of your organization has developed a resource, anything like that that you want to share with everyone else, go to that public Google Doc and drop it in. It's not going away, so I guess Google kills the Google Doc. So, it'll be there as a long-standing resource. So, to get things started, we're going to kind of go in two parts in this panel. Well, there are many sides to this issue, but to reflect that we only have an hour or less now of talking about this, we're going to just focus on two. And the first is really some of the issues and examples around organizations in this space. And then the second will be moving more towards the community side and individuals. Obviously, there are individuals in our organizations and communities that are related to organizations. So that's always going to stay consistent. We're really going to try and navigate the question and the conversation that way. So before we get, you know, started with the first question, I just want to see how many people here work for an organization, whether it's a nonprofit or for profit or any organization, actually for an organization. You're not like an independent consultant. Okay, a lot of people. So how many of you feel that if you have a Facebook page or a Twitter account that has your name, like, in your sword, and even when you're tweeting under that, you are associated with your organization? Okay, so that's like 75% of the original chance. Those that don't, have you made it explicit on your account, like, my opinions do not reflect my employer? Do you have an actual, like, clause statement? Okay, running through those. So we might, when we get to some of those questions and conversations, ask for the clause people to share a bit about why, how you created that, if that was your own decision, et cetera. And then back to the organization question. How many people are employed as one of the many to-do list items to actually tweet on behalf of the organization with another account profile? Okay, a lot of people. Cool. So I'm really hoping, and whether it's through incentive or awkwardly not, that you guys share, because this is just 3/4 people's opinions and experiences, and there's a lot of other experiences in the room. At the end of the day, or at the end of the session, you know, we're not going to say this is the answer, or this is the solution, or even this is the best practice. There are better practices than others. But there is really no specific answer, just because it is a gooey gray space that isn't really there to get less gray at this point. So I want to dive in, and the first question is going to go to Jess. And, you know, as organizations trying to be engaged online, start creating these profiles and enable maybe even just one staff person to manage that account, what are some of the issues, or if there's a specific example you can share of, you know, what happens when it is one person kind of becoming a person on an organization channel?
Yeah, so I've worked with a number of organizations that really are a staff of one and have either not been in social media because of that, because it's just one more thing to do, and worked with them to help get online. And one of the organizations that I worked with, but I didn't actually establish the social media presence for, but I've followed it very closely. The staff of one director of the organization became very active on Twitter as the name of the organization, not as a personal Twitter handle. And the thing that I watched happen was that she's got a great personality, and it really came through. And a lot of the people that started following, I think there was a personal connection at first. And so it grew really nicely. And I did see, though, over time, that the conversation really strayed quite a bit from the mission of the organization and the things that the organization was most involved in, and started to, you know, there started to be a lot of conversation about what was for breakfast and something, an appreciation for her significant other. And then when she went on maternity leave, there was nothing. It was just, I even went back and double checked, and there were actually no tweets for about 3 months. And I think that on the one hand, it's really entertaining Twitter feed to follow, and I actually love reading about it, reading about what she has to say. On the other hand, I feel like there's some danger in terms of the branding of the organization getting muddled and confused, I worry about the evolution of the organization in terms of what happens next, what happens when she moves on someday, and who's going to take the reins, and how is the community that's been built around the way that she's telling the story of the organization and her own life, how is that community going to react, and are they going to continue to be a community?
Anyone have a conversation with your organization to share?
Oh, but I'm going to save it for a second.
You can totally
I'm going to save it, I promise. It'll be good.
Okay, cool. So, Deborah, then, from the perspective of a organization, you know, having this personal almost morph of the channel, what about organizations that are so fearful of even the perception of personal as a brand or as a cause that it kind of becomes watered down?
Yeah. I'm working with an organization that's the opposite of that. So they they are pretty fear-based, actually. Their mission is, I always joke that their mission is sort of to negotiate world peace. And I don't joke about that. They really are in the Middle East dealing with world peace issues, and they're negotiating, very, very difficult, bringing people together who absolutely oppose each other on so many issues. Think Earth first versus the people that want to cut trees down, okay? And so they are focused on their process and the process of negotiation, and that is what they are trying to teach. That is their mission. And they are comprised of therapists, trained psychologists. And there are a number of issues now that come into this. So they want people to take their classes. That would be their goal. And creating community is to learn this process of negotiation so that they can, maybe there will be world peace one day. And, the individual therapists, don't want to be on social media because they don't want people to friend them, because their role is to be a therapist and not people's friends. And as an organization, and both their Twitter and their Facebook communities, they are prohibited from expressing any opinions because that could hinder any current or future negotiations that they participate in. So it's fear but yet practical based as well. And as a result, it has been exceptionally difficult to grow any kind of what we would call rabid fan engagement, right? Because you can't be seriously devoted to a process. I mean, I think that's really the takeaway here. It's very hard to be a rabid fan of a process. Think of any process. And that is something that we struggle with. I was just talking with Christy, right? Who, may have something to say about this, hint, hint, in a minute. And, one of the things that I really take away from this is that they are focused solely on branding. But what we all know, at least in this panel, I don't know about in this room, is that it is important to bring the personal in. That is how we all connect because we're human beings and that's how we build community. When I was a community organizer, I used to call it friend organizing. You know, I would say I'm friend-based organizing. Bring your friends to the meeting. And that's what we want to do is bring our friends to the meeting. But if you can't be friends with anyone and you can't express opinions, well, I don't really want to be friends with the process. They're really in a really difficult situation. We've got some solutions, but I just wanted to express the issue here. And leave it at that and say, you know, one of the things that could help them is to think about it. Where can they feel comfortable bridging that? How can you bring your humanity in a little bit?
Questions? Do you have any
examples to that question? Yeah. I don't want to hear resource now. I work for a highly regulated.
Do you have 12 different profiles, or is there one master?
One master. Okay. So that's a different challenge, probably for a different discussion and big debate. But what I was going to say is that so because we're regulated and we have customers who use our service and they don't have a choice, it's very important to get them to go to calls because we're a dispatch-based service.
Well, I mean, gas utilities, people are passionate about, but maybe not the way you want. Yeah. Yeah.
Very careful with their as with all companies. issues, if it's an employee talking about a fellow employee, or privacy issues having to do with their accounts. You know, the fact that they choose to only pay their account when they feel like it because that's their personal, they want to pay every 3 months, you know, but they haven't communicated that to us, and so we don't show them off. Do they come and complain? Well, we can't say publicly, you know, you can't just pay your bill whenever you want. Or even if it's something much less severe, I can't say anything about their account. And so what I'm thinking of doing is if they have the option set up, either through Twitter, email, or both friends, or Facebook, the option, is to just email them, send them to know that you would typically want the public to see. If it enhances your brand, it's that personal, you know, best practice, the me caring about the person's situation, say, I'm an employee, I'm here to help, here's my direct line, you don't need the results that you're looking for. It's a real shame that we can't do that publicly and kind of follow the practices. But it is a way around kind of what you were saying, the not showing it, it's still the way.
I don't remember the exact words, of course, they were just like 30 seconds ago, but they, about, you want to show that you care as a human, and, you know, that is at the heart of what we're talking about today, is people oversharing and people undersharing, and how to do it.
But I think also from, you know, like from a customer service perspective, I mean, I think we're often thinking, you know, things like Twitter and such are great because we get to amplify that level of customer service and we get to amplify our involvement in that high touch. But at the end of the day, even though you're not publicly sharing that, you have just made a high touch point and a loyalty touch point with that specific individual. And I think often we're forgetting that and we're forgetting the importance of that. So I understand from a PR and marketing perspective, it would be great to be able to share that on a larger scale. Just because you can't doesn't mean that it's not as effective and that you're not actually adding a huge amount of value that I think a lot of people who are doing those more public exchanges are not necessarily. So, you know, I think the thing, you know, there's no one prescribed way. And I think that story is very, I think, meaningful and very valuable, I think, to this room at large, because, you know, we're not always having that conversation because we're so wrapped up now in sort of the amplification and the larger reach, where sometimes it just takes one really high quality touch point to
really good point.
Be, yeah.
And the fact,
as a brand manager, we kind of get all wrapped up in how great the story would be, you know, to enhance our brand. At the end of the day, it's really about helping that one person.
We're going to go here, and then over here, and then we're going to do another question. I was going to say, I work for a public library in Arizona, and we have a really critical interior presence. And it's one of the reasons.
Oh, give her a mic.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know.
Can everybody hear me back?
Yeah. Oh, it works now.
Oh, yeah.
I work for a public library in Arizona, and we have a great Facebook and Twitter presence. And one of the reasons we have a great Facebook and Twitter presence, a very warm and connected one, is that the person who's in charge of it came at it not from a marketing standpoint. She said, this isn't marketing. This is customer service. This is like we're standing at the reference desk, and a person walks up. Whether they're doing it through Twitter saying, why haven't you ordered this book for the library, or they're doing it on Facebook. I had this real problem with one of the, you know, something that happened at a branch. She responds to that as if they're standing in front of her. So, I mean, obviously, when it's in public like that, there's some things you can say and some things you can't say, but, you know, librarians are inherently helpful. It's kind of a... kind of a pathology. And she approaches it from that standpoint, is that it's a customer service.
Yeah, no, it's a great point, and just like great word to bring into the conversation, because I think a lot of nonprofits, through adopting more social channels and technology, have realized that just as much as their organization does have direct service or programs, they are a cause and a brand and could even be a movement if they wanted to be. And in that same kind of transformation into terms that normally are reserved for profits, a lot of nonprofits have realized, oh, we do customer service. We do try to like connect and help people, even though it isn't just showing up and using that service. Sometimes it's just letting them know it's a different organization that they need. So we're going to go right here and then keep moving.
Mine was actually a question comment back towards your point. I just wanted to clarify my mind. I know you mentioned you can't always tweet the contents of what's going on, like, well, you didn't pay your bill, those embarrassing things. You can't give that email conversation on Twitter, but do you ever tweet out saying, oh, I just sent you an email, or I'll be sending you an email? Is that made public?
Yeah, I used to identify myself, both on Twitter and Facebook, as who I am, you know, as a social manager. I've since made it much less personal, which I guess is kind of what we're talking about here today, because I didn't want to associate as an employee. Mm-hmm.
You probably shouldn't say all this stuff right now. Yeah.
Your last name. I mean, we need an address or an account number. Yeah. Usually the last name, we can find that person. Our customer service people, if they know there's an issue, they'll call them. They'll find them. Mm-hmm. They'll figure out what the situation is. So it's a way to get those issues offline. But today,
you did. I work for, it's a similar situation for myself, for a membership organization, and we have those similar types of issues, and we can easily find your email, whatever, but we just make a point to say publicly,
yes,
you know, we're emailing, calling, so the public who's following that knows it's been addressed, even though they can't see what that email looked like.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to do one more, and then I'm going to force questions back from you.
So I represent a large B2B company, and we kind of went full circle about 2 years ago when I started. I used my personal Twitter handle to pretty much do everything for the company, right? But fairly quickly realized that this is not a sustainable way of doing and moving forward. So now we do have these branded handles, but in addition to my personal and all my team members' personal handles that are there to not actually answer questions, but primarily to thank people when they mention us, and that's a good connection. But I actually have a question that puzzled me about a couple of months ago when we had a customer who was very angry at us. So he went ahead and sought all of our Twitter handles and put all of them in a row and said how awful we are and personally called us names within that Twitter, within that tweet. And I'm wondering whether you know, what to do with an instance like that and how to address it. We ended up letting it go. But and it keeps on surfacing once in a while. So I don't know any strategies for that.
We at NTech, I don't know why it makes that awful sound. I'm sorry. at NTech, okay. Just hold this.
You turn it off.
Use it.
Turn it off.
I know,
it's off.
It's off. Okay, thank you.
You know, most all of the staff are extremely publicly accessible, and we broadcast that you can reach us in any way to try and nurture community, to try to create those communication paths. But it also means that when someone is upset, we get an email to not just every single staff, every alias they can think of, most of which we do actually have set up forward. But if, you know, they want a response right away, same thing, you know, they will just tag everyone's individual page that they can find on Facebook. They will include every Twitter handle. And our process for dealing with that is first tell everyone, in case someone, you know, people don't have to be dead or something, you know, that just happened. And then pick who is the one person that should respond. It isn't always a good director, but it's the person who's had the engagement with them to know why they're pissed off. If it was about a webinar and they couldn't get into it and they're all mad, well, it doesn't need to be me as the membership director that says, okay, calm it down, we will get you the login information, but it's someone that they would work with on a daily basis about webinars so that we're maintaining the most trusted relationship so that doesn't break down. And then going forward, they think, I always have to go to Amy to get what I really want. Or I always have to go to Holly. But, you know, make sure that staff person knows how to respond so they can continue to be seen as trusted and know what the hell to do. You know, so we don't break.
I have an interesting thing. So one of my clients is a B2B as well. And there was a client of theirs who was very unhappy with order fulfillment on so many levels. And the truth is that my client really messed it up. I mean, they did. And they owned that. So that's the first thing. Like, if you really mess it up, you got to own it. Really? Because if you don't own it, oh, will you be slammed on social media, right? If you really mess it up. And that's a whole other panel discussion that's probably happening right now at South By. But what we did was, after the order was fulfilled and the client was relatively satisfied, you know, I don't think if you mess up that badly, you'll ever be totally satisfying that client. But what we did was we approached the client and said, would you mind, we give you free rein to write a blog post. We will not edit your blog post other than we are going to ask you to tell the truth about what happened, like what we tried to do to rectify this issue. And we know you're not in love with us anymore, like you probably were before you put your order in. But in an effort of transparency to show that we are working with you. And they wrote the blog post, and it was a fine blog post. We only gave them 400 words. but that was trying to make some lemonade out of some lemons that worked for us.
Cool. So I want to transition to get a question to Vanessa before we move into the individual side of things. So another, you know, there are lots of profiles, and they're all broadcasted, like this is every single staff person's Twitter. Some are probably more interesting to follow than others. But what about organizations that really do just have one channel, or maybe one or two, and there's one person really rocking it out, and then maybe they're sick that day? Something happens. And do you have an example of like that really defined one person role that then, what are the issues around there?
So, in sort of my experiences with both the four and the nonprofit ventures that have worked with them, we sort of see three issues. It's the knowledge management component of that. There's just this huge increase of information. And then, you know, you put in sort of the capacity issue, obviously, when you're a smaller organization, and then the scalability and sustainability. And so I think, you know, we're seeing a really interesting, unique challenge with the increase of information and not only the need to try to figure out how to just, to see it and capture it, but how do we transfer it? And how do we observe it and transfer it in a way that's also mindful of the real-time piece? So, and this feeds actually a little bit back to sort of what Jess, when she was sort of, in terms of like, again, when you have a small organization, you just have one individual who is managing, say, a Twitter account, and then you have a little bit of the personal and a little bit of the professional. And again, also, as you were speaking to previously, when you're also just getting started and how you transition sometimes and where that started in the individual, it becomes really, really important, especially when those lines are really muddled, to have a system in place where that information is being shared with the other members of the team or whoever else is involved in your organization. And sort of the reason being, so I worked with a very small chocolate company, and they had a fantastic individual who was managing a lot of their social media outlets, specifically on Twitter, and had built up a really robust, highly engaged community around sort of the sort of slow food movement and other, you know, food sort of in that vein. But unfortunately, one day he left in a very abrupt manner, which was problematic in a multiple ways. They didn't have the capacity, just being a small startup, to even be able to manage it on the scale that he had been doing, which was probably upwards of 20 plus tweets a day, highly engaged information. Nobody actually had the level of expertise in that space that he had. So they couldn't even engage with the community at the level that they had become accustomed to. And I think that's the other thing. The reason that there was such a need for the sharing of information is just that, so that everybody's on the same page. But you're also very aware of what's the expectation of the people in which you're engaging with. And they had a really high expectation, you know, in terms of what Jess saying, like with a woman going on maternity leave for 3 months, like in my book, that's so not acceptable because it's the harsh reality, I think, of a lot of organizations, especially very small one or two person shops. And so, you know, I think the biggest lesson learned, I think both, for them as a small company, I think, and one of the things that I'm incredibly mindful when I'm consulting with the social entrepreneurs that are coming through our door who are just getting started is you know, almost looking at it in terms of the reverse of what's the, you know, what expectation and do you want to also set with your community so that when you do, you know, so that it isn't just focused on the one individual, so that the loyalty isn't actually with the individual who's tweeting. The loyalty is back to your company, your organization, and your nonprofit. And in some ways, it seems like it's an issue of semantics. It's so fine, and you have to really pay attention to these three different parties, but it can really hurt when it starts to tip into that other space. And again, it's the walkaway factor. You know, my just your litmus is if you were to remove that one person at the end of the day, are they having a conversation with that person or are they having a conversation with your organization? And if the question is that person, you have to seriously look and how do you transition that back? Sorry, and if I wasn't loud enough.
So, as the moderator, I'm going to steal it. But they have a great example that's the total opposite of the scale issue that I just want to share, and that is, you know, it became very apparent to them that they needed to make sure there was documentation and information about how to log on and use the different organizational channels because day to day they have multiple staff, you know, to manage how many communications they have engaging there. But when a crisis happens, to an organization like Planned Parenthood that is huge and everyone, whether you like them or not, wants to go like scream or cheer on their Facebook page, they can't even refresh that page fast enough. So they make sure that everyone in the organization or in the position they could knows how to get on so that when they say it's more than the three of us can handle, staff from the advocacy team can also be helping respond to questions on the Facebook page, or staff from the communications can be helping people, you know, either just respond and say this is where they get the information about that service or whatever, so that they can maintain their level of we do respond to people and answer questions, but sometimes you just can't at the scale of real crisis.
So my name is Joel, and I work for Oxfam, and I tweet at Oxfam, and I have a personal account, so I'm really excited, because I think at the end of this week, on the Oxfam account, I'm going to get 250,000 views.
Yay, Oxfam. You have to tell us the secret sauce. Yeah.
I know. Well, I'll tell you the secret sauce, but but yeah, all of these things really resonate to me. Vanessa, you talk about small organizations. I work for a really large organization, but I have a really small team. So when I come to South by Southwest, I actually just got a virus on my computer last night. So I can't tweet. I'm freaking out.
You want to borrow my machine?
Yeah.
Yeah. Come up here.
The document, and in fact, I had to do it when I went on holiday for a couple of weeks in November for Thanksgiving in the United States. I'm based in the UK. I put together how to tweet at Oxfam. So it's like, here are the priorities. Here's, you know, sort of, you know, how you just sort of how to. So, you know, the three E's, right? Educate, entertain, and engage. And so that engages with what you were saying about when someone writes to you. So write to me about, you know, this Oxfam person came up and talked to me on the street, you know, I hate Oxfam. You know, obviously I don't have to respond to those, but it's like when people write, I need to change my address, so I need to know who is the right person to send that on to. So those types of very specific customer service angles. And then also just back to the original discussion about the personal versus the professional. When our media guy was in Haiti, he started his account. It was like, we need to get stuff out quick. He was there, so he put it in Louis Oxfam. And that was great, actually, for the first couple of months, because then, you know, the New York Times and CNN could know that who he was with Oxfam. But then, after a while, you know, he starts tweeting these big Yankees fans. And I'm like, you're tweeting about the Yankees, but it's just Louis Oxfam, so that doesn't jive. And so I talked to some of the digital managers in the organization, put together a little policy that says if you're going to basically said you can't put Oxfam in your personal account. Just because inevitably someone's going to wake up and be like, I need coffee today. and that doesn't associate with our mission. So anyway, I'll stop talking very quickly, but that was, I have some pushback from the media team, so we said, okay, with a few folks, you can, well, grandfather you maybe, you can keep Oxfam in your name, but just, you know, just tweet about Oxfam business.
And so, well, so I think sort of with that, I mean, again, so Start Some Good is very small. And so, you know, for us, what we've done is that, you know, we have our main Twitter account, and then Tom, our co-founder, and myself. I mean, I have an array of other folks that I work with and things that I'm doing. So I'm always very vocal of, you know, directing. Again, so it's keeping that, like, the personal professional separate. Like, I'm always very mindful of when I'm working to start some good stuff in terms of directing people back to that space, and they can interact with me personally or professionally or in any other capacity, but always sort of migrating them back. And Tom, myself, and Alex all manage that specific account. But when there's a major disruption, I mean, we also have all very different tones. We try really hard to manage that, but there's always a nuance. And so, you know, the simple answer for us in that capacity of what we've done is in terms of just doing the little asterisk of, with our initials, and then also stating very clearly in the bio that there's multiple people. And then I think Tom and I, just because I think we're hyper aware of this more so than most people are. And so from our own personal account, like when I was coming down here, I made it very clear that I was going to be down here, and that if people need to start some good stuff, that they would just, you know, like to hear the other people. And I'm going to be kind of gone. And just, that's just my own. I think that the other part of this is that, you know, I think we all feel a personal due diligence as, you know, community organizers, community managers, and all in that space of also, you know, that when we do make action, how can we also help to support those pieces? So,
can I offer one good practice? I'm sorry, I've been dying to say it, which is, it touches on a little bit of what you were talking about, giving access to the Twitter accounts. Whenever I work with a nonprofit, I always suggest two things. I say, set up an account at your organization, which is social at, name of organization. That's the account that should open up your social media assets. Facebook's different, obviously it has to be a person. But then post that, create a Google Doc that is completely shared to the people within the organization only, of course, and that has the email, the passwords that are affiliated with every social media account. And it's not just those social media accounts, right? It's Bitly, it's TweetDeck, it's all those others, Hootsuite, blah, blah, blah. And if you have a company that is relatively hierarchical and bureaucratic, where that's very hard to get that email, then I always suggest, for instance, I have a client I'm working with now, an elder abuse center in New York, and they just created nyceacsocial@gmail.com, and that's the one that they'll use. You know, so there is always a workaround, but that's a good practice so that it's not affiliated with one person.
Thank you.
Ask some questions. The transition is over from the organization part of the conversation to the individual part. And, you know, I think that even in an organizational channel, maybe you're supporting an online community, whether it's white label or not, or you're just thinking of your Twitter followers as a community, what happens, or what would you like to offer as an example, to orient us around, you know, when all of those people that normally we think of ourselves as speaking out to or like wrapping our arms around actually start maybe having conversations we don't want amongst themselves in our sandbox?
Mm-hmm. So I also worked with a health-based startup, and folks obviously from the health community know that it's a really sensitive community to work with. It's a really awesome community in many, many ways. They're extremely supportive and vocal, and nurturing of each other, I think as a result of having a very shared experience and other sort of points of empathy. This particular space was an online sort of community, again, enabling connections, but sort of the big button there is because you're dealing with highly emotionally charged issues and people, that sometimes it would turn into a space where it would become a shouting match in terms of whose issue or illness or situation was more important, than the others, or whose, specific, life, you know, path within a specific space was more dire and more, was harder than somebody else's. And so, you know, the challenge, at least in that capacity as a community manager, you know, and this comes to, even in terms of what you were, the example in terms of Twitter and customer service, of like, how do you then start to rein in the dialogue so that, you know, you don't squash the conversation because it's your community and these are things that are important to them. So that's the individual piece. It's important to them, but move the conversation forward in a way so that the community remains a space where everybody can participate and have a dialogue and move it into a productive space. And so I think it's a really interesting, it was a really interesting challenge in terms of, you know, a couple pieces, being able to acknowledge the issue and acknowledge how that individual felt, but also to, and again, this goes back to, we had a certain amount of best policies and procedures in place and expectations that are set with the community, so that then also reining it in and encouraging the community publicly that we want to move this into a space where it's also productive and other people can feel like they can either contribute to the conversation or not, but that we also don't tolerate, you know, I think it's just setting an expectation, like here, like we also set an expectation of very open, supportive dialogue. That doesn't always mean it has to be positive conversation, but the conversations are had in a positive manner. So being very proactive, again, in terms of moving it forward.
Great. First off, really enjoying the conversation. And I work for a public B-12 district in Arizona. By the way, our social media director is a former teacher who's a stay-at-home mom now, and she makes a few bucks doing it for us, so so, here's a question. What about what we call parallel interest communities? A lot of our neighborhood associations have their own Facebook pages and their own communities. And so, our person inserts herself in there because our business comes up in the context of their conversations. And so, our person, Linda, often looks to insert herself in those conversations. Do you have, first off, have you seen that now? What's your best practices for how to engage in those parallel interest communities? They're not yours, but they're talking about your stuff.
Oh, yeah, I did shoot you. Oh, so on a smaller scale, so one of the other projects that I work on is called the Urbana-Champaign Big Broadband Project in East Central Illinois. And we deal with this problem, you know, this challenge. Yeah, yes, but I'm like, problem, it's a problem. No, this challenge, or the challenge that I face there is that, so a lot of different stakeholders having slightly different leanings in terms of the conference. So we're working with two different cities. We're working with teachers. We're working with folks who are actually helping, like construction workers. I mean, there's all these different pieces. And so what we've done, actually a lot of ways with our sort of our Twitter and our Facebook account, is provide a space to we sort of reach out to them in the capacity of there's so much sharing that needs to happen among those constituents. And so we insert ourselves in terms of sharing the information across and sort of to acknowledge the parallel sort of communities, but also that at least within such a small community where I live, that there's this desire to also bring it together. And so we try to provide a space in terms of our Facebook page. The other part for us that's different is that we bring in physical, local opportunities to bring everybody together, to have the conversation together, which has been really powerful. It's not always something that's accessible, obviously, depending on what scale or obviously where people are. But in that capacity, being able to do that has been great because it's made it that much easier for me in terms of interacting with those individual groups to build a level of loyalty, but also understanding of the different pieces. And by bringing them together, they've been able to understand what each of them also bring to the table and being able to sort of have cross information, which has been actually, it's provided a level of momentum with the project that far exceeded.
So, Deborah, yeah. Put a question to you. I think both of those examples are examples where the community manager is very formally still recognized as the community manager, or the organization's profile is recognized as the organization's profile. What about when you're working in situations where you are formally the community manager of, you know, on behalf of that organization, but the community no longer sees you in that role and instead sees you as a peer or a friend or whatever? What happens then?
Great. And I'm also very interested in hearing what you guys have to say about this as well after our talk. So I was the digital community manager at firstgiving.com, an online fundraising platform, and there were no rules or regulations in place whatsoever. I've come to find out later, actually, that the parent company, JustGiving.com, has lots of rules and regulations. I don't know why they never trickled down to us in the U.S., but whatever. So we have a Facebook page at FirstGiving, and I would often try and like do the little caret and say Deborah after it if there was something where I was answering with an I sentence. And we decided to break off to the community into to two interest groups, people who were interested in joining these two interest groups in Facebook. So there was a FirstGiving group for runners community and a FirstGiving for animal lovers, because those were, to be perfectly honest, the people who were most passionate on our page were these runners and animal lovers, and then lots of people talked about their illnesses. go on about that, and their children who are very sick. So the FirstGiving for runners, here we are, we've broken it off into a group, but I don't know if you're familiar, but you can't be FirstGiving and manage a group. In a group, you have to be Deborah Askenaze. Deborah Askenaze has to admin this group. And when I'm posting as my photo, not FirstGiving, which I personally prefer. I feel more comfortable with that anyway. Not everybody does, FYI. And we had a wonderful, incredibly cohesive group that came together where people were donating to other people's running causes and running events, and they were saying, how can we publicize each other? And it was wonderful sharing. And the next thing I know, I am getting hundreds of friend requests on Facebook. And I professionally don't trust Facebook. Anybody here from Facebook? But I did put everybody into a list that's called FirstGiving People I Don't Know. And that was, and really, that's what I put. And actually, I blocked them from seeing every single thing that I put on my profile, other than something very, very, very specific, info about me, like the info page. And I didn't let them see my updates. But that really became an issue because there were people who would talk to me. They post to my wall, and then I had to like remember to not let them post to my wall. And they would talk to me as a friend, and at the same time, I'm FirstGiving. And this became actually a bit problematic for me personally. Also problematic for the organization because I wasn't building the organization as much as they were having a relationship with me. And then the last thing that I wanted to point out was, on the other hand, what this did do was we tracked it, and the people who came out of these groups significantly increased the amount of money they raised from the year before. They also were highly, you know, we tried to point them to the page. They were much more highly interactive on the actual page on Facebook than the other folks. And that's where we got our guest bloggers from. We had guest bloggers that would blog for 3 months at a time. And of course, I knew them personally. I would ask them if they could guest blog. So there's like the pro and the con of this. And I feel like you have to be friends with the people in your community if you're a community manager. But that line is so hard, and that was very challenging for me, I have to say. And I'd love to learn from the experience of the group here.
Yeah, and I also want to set up Jess to respond to that,
yeah,
too, in that, not in Deborah's case, she was the community manager. Had there been policies, there probably would have been one that addressed her role.
there still aren't, sadly.
Public media, nonprofit, any kind of content creation organization, what can you do proactively, whether it's formal policies or suggestions or training, for those people that could be in a position that even the community sees as representing the organization, whether they are 24/7 or not? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I think, from a public media perspective, there are hundreds of stations, and they're all different sizes, and they're all different. They're across the full spectrum of involvement in social media and these kinds of things. And so there's a lot that stations are figuring out. And one of the things that we're seeing, come up is that, stations really want to have that community engagement online. And they also recognize that many of them are journalistic organizations, and they have a responsibility to uphold the public trust and make sure that they're, if they are doing local journalism, that they're following those editorial integrity standards and that kind of thing. And this doesn't really hold true just for public media stations. Government arts organizations that I've worked with, I know, have had similar issues of being part of government, but wanting to have community engagement and dealing with those issues. And I think that, one of the things, that I think is in the booklet as well, is that some, stations in creating policy, are, you know, recognizing both sides of the coin. So on the one hand, they recognize that the folks that work at the station or work in public media have the potential to confuse the brand or say, you know, if they're identified as being part of the station or of this journalistic organization, that they could potentially engage in political activities or something online that may indicate some sort of bias. On the other hand, everyone working in public media or these other kinds of organizations has the real potential to help add to the community and help things go viral or just spread, you know, some great initiatives or whatever is going on. Spread the word about something awesome. And so, you know, in looking at policy and creating policy, it's important for organizations to think about, guidelines for personal use, if that's something that, if there is an understanding that working at your organization, you might just have to acknowledge that there are things that you're going to have to agree to in your personal life. So if you're going to identify, for example, I identify on Twitter that I work for my organization, and that came about because people just started finding me. And I chose to do that, and once I did that, and so that people were recognizing they were finding the right Jess Main, I also chose to make sure that the content of my tweets was professionally appropriate, and that's something I recognize that I'm doing because I'm part of this industry that has this editorial integrity concern. I think that expands beyond. So I think it's definitely part of the policy. You may want to look at the context in terms of some stations say, okay, you know, people who are in editorial roles need to follow these set of guidelines. If you're maybe in a more administrative role, but you're still working here and people may identify you as being here, this is your set of guidelines. So it really depends on the organization, but there are some things you can do.
And many of these policies aren't new, even though they currently, maybe in your handbook, don't mention social media. For example, I worked at a private foundation. Well, we were not allowed to put any kind of social impact or campaign or political bumper sticker on our car, because if we drove to a site visit for a grantee and they saw that we supported a candidate that wanted to close them down, you know, I'm a Margaret conservative, really, okay, so by this thing, for me, it was my body. So, you know, and that's not a new thing, it's just applying it to some people. So I want to make sure we have a couple more rounds of comments before we wrap up. We're going to go here, 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 and then that might be it. But then you're not going anywhere. So we can just, I guess we can physically leave so someone else can be here, but we can keep talking right up there.
So, follow up.
Did she stump us?
Well, I'm thinking.
I work with startups. We're not even there on the policies and procedures.
Well, yeah, and I think that that's something that is being explored, and I don't have a ready answer for you. I know that in public media, for example, there are some journalists that are choosing to create like their journalist page, and that people can subscribe. And I think those are, you know, potentially, under the umbrella of the station, even though it bears their name. But that's sort of where they're doing their professional work versus, you know, a personal profile. But I actually don't have an example of a full scale, legal document or legal process that's gone on within an organization. I don't know.
Maybe somebody here does.
Yeah, I was just going to say, at least it's not on the same level of that, but because, like I said, my hobby is also my professional space, in all of my jobs, I had it written down
or whatever, but it was written down that even if it was technically during 9-to-5, if it was on my blog, it was fine. And that we just had it in writing that we were separating those channels or those spaces because it was, you know, we just wanted to preempt any blurring of the public saying, is that really saying that about some technology acquisition as end-to-end or as percent? And so making sure it's already in writing that those are separate spaces and one is really just me and one is, you know, me supporting end-to-end. That at least made me and my organization feel better that we knew what the line was. We actually had that conversation. So they were never questioning, oh, well, if you put it on her Twitter or her blog, there's, you know, people think like that. So we could be explicit before we even started.
Well, I was just saying, and again, because I think it's on the scale of the places that we are, but I'm seeing it more like in the, like the initial contract. So like with Starts and Good, it was in my, we set it up in the initial contract of what the expectation was around, for instance, my own content, and very similar actually also with like TechSoup. And so kind of living there, at least that there's some, we're making the line, which is, I think is the important component.
Right. So we don't have much more time, so we're going to go into it. So there's one here, and then somewhere else that we do.
I think we're always so afraid to say no. I mean, I think that, like, you know, like right now with sort of feeling like, you know, everything's so wrapped up or personal or professional, and then you throw these complicating lines in, and I think that, you know, I think for myself, I mean, I make my Facebook is mine. I don't, it's like that's, I have pictures of my daughter, my, you know, I keep that very separate. And I made a very conscious decision, a part of this, I'm okay with saying no. And I have chosen which channels and how that is. And I think that people need to be less afraid to also do that. And that's okay. And that, you know, these things can live in much smaller pieces and that's fine.
I've also seen, if in fact, you know, you were interested in having a Twitter presence in terms of your professional life and not, you know, not just simply your personal life, I know that some folks actually will, create some direction within their, the description on their Twitter page that says, you know, for tweets about, you know, Senator X or whatever, you know, please see me at this, or, you know, personal use only or something like that, that instructs people that may be interested because of your professional affiliation to go find you in this other venue.
Great. So there will be a door.
Should we each just do a takeaway, or are you going to do a last question? Excellent. Excellent. Okay.
We are staying.
One more, and then we'll do just some last words.
Great.
My question is,
I'm going to take a stab at this. So this is my recommendation, is to make it super clear. Put everyone on and say everyone is on and they are professional and personal and they must say that they work for your utility company if they're doing that, if they're going to tweet ever about your utility company, right? Even one tweet means they have to put it up there. Right. And I'm not sure that muddies the water. I think that equals accessibility. However, I think what can muddy the water is the folks that everyone knows they work for the utility company, but they're not acknowledging it. So somebody very high up, for example. You know, low down, like the wire worker, you know, that's fine. But your CFO, she needs to put that up there.
One more thing that I'll say about that from NTEN's social media policy, which I'm happy to share anyone that wants to see what our policy looks like, is we take the assumption that the community thinks we are representing NTEN all the time on personal channels. And so instead of creating a policy that says you can't use things or this is how you have to use them, we just assume it's going to happen, whether or not we want it to, and give some support to staff so that if someone does tweet at their personal profile at midnight on a Saturday that says, how do I register for the conference, we've already said, don't feel like you have to respond until Monday, or, you know, follow up on email. Or if someone tweets at you with that angry message, and it's really, you know, supposed to be to the N10.org Twitter account, don't worry about it. It's okay. Don't feel like you broke some law. So we provide examples of what people may say to staff personally, directly, and how to respond. And, you know, if it's something that needs to go to the org account or not, because we just felt like it was a better position to take to assume it would happen and then give people the support they need to make it okay versus them seeing like, oh, bummer. it's really hard to like make my brain think of not swearing.
oh, bloody.
I'm sorry. I work at home from my office, and I'm not around people. I lose my filter.
It's South by Amy. You can swear here.
What shall I tweet back to this very passionate person? You know, we just assume passionate people will tweet to us. And give support there. So I'm going to stop before I actually swear. And you guys just want to run down the line with some last thoughts, suggestions, favorite cat names, I don't know, whatever you want to share.
Pearl? I think that the main thing, and I think it just came up, is identify, you know, having a personal presence from an organizational account can really work very well and really quickly. One of the case studies that's in the packet that we have, and there are more if you didn't get a chance to ask your question. One of my absolute favorite case study in there is from an organization or a station that changed their format. And got a lot of comments, both good and bad, on their Facebook page because they used their Facebook page to make the announcement. And the way they handled it was really, really nicely done. And it used the professional station Facebook page with personal responses, with people identifying themselves to respond to people. And they had a lot of success with it. So that's all. That's my last point. Check it out.
You know, I think to think critically, I mean, there's no silver bullet on a lot of this stuff, and it's only going to continue to get more and more complex. But I think if you are constantly looking at these in terms of what's the perceptional component from the outside and a little less from, like, where you're standing, to have that help to drive you, because, I mean, really it's the perception piece and how all these different pieces, and be willing to say no to different parts and be willing to do things differently and do what works for your organization. You know, take all this. But, you know, you guys are experts within your organization. You know your community. You know what works, what doesn't work, and where those pain points or those nuances are. So trust that.
I'm going to make a plug for something I uploaded to the Bitly doc. So just a reminder that there is this document here that has some good resources in it. And I uploaded an ebook that Blaise Vort Grimes put together on 60 insights from community managers that I know, wink, wink, there's somebody in this room who's in that book. And it has a lot of, it talks about a lot of these issues, and there's several really good quotes about that personal personnel space. I think it's worth looking through. It's like one quote per page kind of thing. And just my last thing is I think it's really important to be personal in community spaces as an organization. The question is, how does that, A, continue to make sure that knowledge is shared
when you're doing it as an individual, a lot of what Vanessa talked about, and B, fit into the, continue to grow the mission of your company and your organization in doing so. And it's, yeah, it's only going to get muddled. Welcome to the conversation.
The last word I want to leave everyone with is with a to-do item. Is why not give you all homework? I'm the moderator. So, and that is to go back to your organization and just start writing all of this down, because your policies, the way you want to handle things, the decisions you make, whether it's a formal legal policy or not, is going to stem out of your culture. And your organizational culture is formed every day in those really small things of how you decide whether you actually get to order pizza or people can only, like, bring in their own food. You know, all those small decisions you're making as an organization together are exactly the same way we're forming how we do and do not deal on social media. So write it down. You know, when you, I'm going to try out this new tool and I'm going to create a password and login. To Deborah's point, drop it in that Google Doc, even if you never use that tool again, so that it was stored for whoever next comes along and they want to try the tool. Or you decide, hey, here's this really great channel. We're using it. We set up a Tumblr blog. Really, the only parts of our community that are here with us are these small segments. Write that down so that later, yeah, when you launch a campaign that targets those people, you know which tools and which parts of your community other staff can help you engage with. So just write it all down, people. Write it down. That's my to-do. So thank you very much for
coming. Thank you.
Yeah. And,